Welcome to AFP. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined this week by David Goss. We tackle on today's show a CONCACAF World Cup qualifying recap, where we stand after three games. We catch up on the MLS playoff chase, and we check in on Europe, where Alphonso Davies was back, starring for Bayern Munich, plus all of your questions on the mailbag Ask AFP. No Nick Andrade this week, David, so we soldier on without him. I know it's tough, but
we're going to unravel.
DG, we are going to unravel. How are you doing, sir? How was your weekend?
My weekend was good. Saturday, I watched 18 hours of soccer in a row, I think.
18?
I don't know. That number feels exaggerated, but I don't know. It was like 9:30 a.m. or 9 a.m. through till midnight. Does that sound about right? Maybe a little earlier. I'm solo right now in the apartment, so it was a good opportunity to just spread out and watch a ton of soccer. And then Sunday I played pickup for 3 hours to try and do all the things that I'd watched on TV, which I'm incapable of doing. So it was a solid weekend.
It's inspiring. I like how you got out there and tried to follow your dreams, like the pros you watched on TV.
My knees hurt so bad right now.
It's
like crazy.
As someone with the back of a 7-year-old, I'm well with you there. I love to ask this though on Saturday, because we're going to talk about some of the great games and like BVB Leverkusen and Chelsea running ride and Manchester United doing the same. But what was the worst soccer you watched on Saturday? Because in those 18 hours, you're bound to catch some real shit. And I'm curious what you came across.
Wow, that's a good question. So I actually, I don't think I actually feel like I saw a really bad game, because we'll talk about it later, but I basically watched the two big Bundesliga games to start out with a little EPL sprinkled in. And it was like West Ham was actually pretty exciting, the close of their game. And then the Chelsea-Aston Villa game was completely won on mistakes, but it didn't feel like it was a garbage game. So it has to be something in MLS. It was probably DC United versus the New York Red Bulls. There you go. I found my answer.
I made a fatal mistake of switching over from the Revs game briefly to watch TFC Cincinnati and missing the Tejan Buchanan goal live and to see some truly horrendous stuff at TQL Park, if that is the name, I believe. But congrats to them for getting that win.
That game?
I think it's TQL Stadium. TQL. Yeah. My bad. Please don't come after me. A bit morbid, you know what? A morbid curiosity, but just to see how they were doing. And yeah, it was a very rough go of it, but we watched a lot of soccer, so we're bound to see some bad stuff. So I like when people are honest about it. It's like, you know what? I wasted 2 hours watching Burnley Everton, which could happen this very day as you record.
I find it hard to do that on weekends like this because there's so many games happening at the same time.
Options, right?
So I watched Leverkusen Dortmund that first half, and I was going to switch over and watch a bunch of Premier League and was like, I'm not, you know what I mean? I switched at halftime, but then I went back because I'm like, not going to turn this game off right now. Yeah, so that's why I feel like it's a little tough. It's tough. The worst is when there's multiple good games and you feel like you're missing out. That's the worst part.
Which happened a bunch, I feel like. Not really this weekend, but maybe last weekend as well.
How many screens do you rock?
Really only two. I have like a big Mac monitor and my TV. So and then I guess if I really want to get squirrely, I can watch on my phone as well. But I think two screens for the most part do me well. I'm such a wreck anxiety wise now watching teams I'm invested in that sometimes I don't even watch them, or I'll watch a different team. And like, it's just, I have to reassess how I watch sports, to be honest, because I'm 33 years old. I can't keep doing this. Watching the Buffalo Bills yesterday was just, I'm like, what, Big Ben? Seriously? Like, what's happening to me?
was the US Open women's final worse on Saturday or the Bills on Sunday? Or Arsenal's grand victory.
Until Arsenal scored, it was very bad. But again, it's just like that fear, right? Like, assuming something bad would happen. The women's tennis final, opposite. Very good vibes. Either person winning would have been fine with. But
do you claim both? Are Canadians claiming both?
We're starting to, it sounds like, in sinister ways. But I think she lists Toronto in her Twitter bio, which my sister sent me. See this? I'm like, all right. So I guess we have a claimant. But she's a citizen of the world now, aka a marketing vehicle to sell a lot of products, people. So get ready. All right. We have to do our brief because Nick is in here. I watched Liverpool for him. So I'll do what I imagine Nick would react how he would react to Liverpool's game. They beat Leeds 3-0 on the road. What a result, David. I mean, that's pretty good, I have to say. Thiago looked like the guy they bought instead of the shadow of the former self version we got.
Well, they bought him because he was supposed to be the guy who could break down teams, you know, with the ball when they sat deep. That's not what this game was. And it turns out that's not really what he's best at either. Like, he's best at finding gaps when the game's open. And he's just so clean technically. And he's such a good passer that then he's able to find gaps. But yeah, he did look good in this one. I was a little shocked by, similar to you, I think just the way this turned out. I had a friend ask me, like, hey, should I put money on both these teams scoring? And I was like, 100%. Mm-hmm. Like, this game's going to be insane, wide open. So for Liverpool to get the shutout is huge here as well. And I think it's a weekend in which you see a couple of the top four teams battle it out. I know they're not in there, but I have Aston Villa in that like top tier of teams. And so I think impressive in those games that Liverpool comes out with a big victory on the back end of the weekend.
Well said. We'll get to more EPL talk a bit later, but a reminder, we are on patreon.com/afootballpodcast. You join us there, you get this show ad free. You get access to the Discord. You also get access to special Patreon only AFP episodes we do after World Cup qualifiers, which we're also going to talk about in a bit, after select games, after big occasions in North American soccer, we usually record something. So it's a pretty good deal. Plus, over on the Discord, we're talking footy all the time. For these low monthly donation, I guess you can call it. I guess donation is a weird way of putting it, but it is basically a donation. Anyways, head on over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast and join today. When we come back, those World Cup qualifiers, CONCACAF region, we're going to talk about how everything sits after the first three games for Canada, the USA, and the rest of the teams coming up next. Welcome back to AFP. Well, after three games, Mexico leads the octagonal round in CONCACAF. Not a surprise, but look who's second. Canada on the magic of, I think, gold. I'm not quite sure how they got this tiebreaker exactly, but they are second. USA third, Panama fourth, all on 5 points. Costa Rica on two, along with Honduras and El Salvador, and then Jamaica on 1 point. This looked right to you, David. I guess based on the merits of how everyone played, that is actually my question. Do you think this is a fair, accurate portrayal of how everything shook out on the field this past week?
Yeah, because one of the parts about World Cup qualifying, especially this cycle, is who are you playing and where are you playing them? For CONCACAF, nothing's more important than road against home. So with these three-game windows, you're always going to play more in one situation than the other. And so this was always going to be how it feels. Like, each cycle, I think, is going to be a huge S curve for every single group, you know, every single team in this and nation in this whole thing. And so I think it's going to look a lot different after the October window, and then it'll come back around after the November one. But overall, I think it was fair for what we saw. Costa Rica was completely underwhelming. They hired a new manager, I think, 1 month ago. And they put together two friendlies for him, but otherwise he really hasn't had an opportunity to manage the team. And we've talked a bit about it on this show. They're in between generations. The in their prime players, just from the outside, I feel, aren't good enough to carry Costa Rica at the level we've expected from them. And they haven't phased out the golden generation yet. And then you've got the players like Ugalde that are coming through as the younger guys. And it doesn't feel like there's a cohesive group that's ready to be a winner. So that one was upsetting. And then for Jamaica, we knew it was going to be tough because that huge group of English players, or English based players, born players that haven't ever played together before. Mm-hmm. They were only available for one of the three games. And so,
and they played the worst
better
game
without
of
them
those.
Than with them. Yeah. So that whole thing was a mess, but I don't blame like a bunch of players who have never met before playing poorly in a game.
And it seems like Theodore Whitmore, the coach, is probably getting some massive heat for that aspect of it. Because, like, sure, you haven't played before, but I think tactically he's been coming under fire for a while. So perhaps a change before the next round is in the offing, just to focus
Although,
in on.
I thought against Panama, they created chances. they gave up, you know, a goal on a turnover and then a shot from 30 yards out. And Andre Blake's the best goalkeeper of the region. So I didn't think Jamaica was awful in that game, but the pressure I think is deserved.
100%. You're sitting bottom. And it's, I guess the positive aspect is there's a hell of a lot of games left. And
yeah,
though you could not really bury yourself, you could definitely make things harder. And I think the United States probably did that for themselves, which we'll talk about. But in terms of Canada, listen, I think if you leave these three games with 5 points, it's okay. It's not maybe ideal. And I think they'll look back on that Honduras game at the end, possibly in regret. But I think the performance against El Salvador, considering the absence of Alphonso Davies and him going back early and some reasonable question marks about how else this team will function without the best player in CONCACAF, I think that performance and how early they scored and really put whispers to bed quickly was massively important. And I think in terms of exiting this round and getting ready for the next one, and it's something to really build off of.
And Devang, this is what we talked about a week or two ago of like what you built in the Gold Cup and in World Cup qualifying when you didn't have David or you didn't have Alphonso Davies was this ability to be able to platoon them if you need to across three games and still have teams out on the field that were capable of beating another team in CONCACAF every single time. Right. And that's what we saw.
And you got, I think, vintage might be putting it a bit over the top, but I think Atiba Hutchinson was excellent. And the fact that he got the goal, I mean, it's icing on the cake, but to see him command the midfield like that was just a breath of fresh air. And also it felt like a, not a victory lap, but a coronation for someone that really deserves it. And getting a showing like that in front of a raucous BMO field, which was, to be truthful, and I was there, maybe 50-50 at best, El Salvadorian Canadian fans, which I think was a bit shocking for some people. And it instigated quite a bit of debate after the game. I think Jonathan Osorio and Mian Borjan were saying like next games, we got to make sure it's all red and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the elephant in the room is that if you have these games in Toronto, you're going to have a sizable population of people from somewhere else who are huge fans who will make sure that they're going to be at this game, just like it was against Honduras. So the other option is not having the games in Toronto, which I don't know if that sends the right message either. I'm curious, as an outsider, David, how you see this.
Well, can I just understand as an outsider? So the belief is that if this game was in Vancouver, it wouldn't be
probably
the same breakdown?
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know if that's like the sole driver of that conversation, obviously, of wanting to have games in other places. It's obviously about spreading this out and making the game available to other people. But I think in terms of a competitive advantage, I didn't really think about it that much, to be honest, until I went to these games and I'm like, oh yeah, shit. Like there's a lot of footy loving people from different countries. And to be fair as well, I saw a lot of El Salvador fans having both flags and cheering, maybe not so much for Canada, but showing out for them as well. But I think the idea of Canada scoring early, not just to steady the non-Fonzie nerves, but to kill off the crowd was huge. Because I think if those people get lit and they see some positive signs, you get not a toxic environment, but you definitely have a situation where the Canadians feel like they're on the road. But I mean, it's interesting to me that they kind of seem slighted by that. Because I don't know why, not to pick a fight, but to kind of pick a fight that you know why. These guys know why it works out like that. Some of them are immigrants themselves, right? So it seemed weird to me.
I agree that it seems weird. And I think a lot of times when we talk about national teams, especially in these two countries, you get into some weird conversations about nationalism and pride and what you're representing and all those things. I would assume the comments from Oso and Borjan are more pointed at Canada fans not coming out than Honduran and El Salvador fans choosing to root for them, right? Because the point is, buy all those tickets, wear red, come to the game, because it wasn't sold out. Neither of them obviously were in COVID as well. So they're
second
not
one
at capacity.
Was that considered the El Salvador a sellout? And yes, I guess in the COVID terms it was.
Right. Okay. So then that's part of it that sucks as well, is you're limiting the tickets. Is there a conversation around? So in the US, obviously we're about to play Costa Rica in Columbus, Ohio. We'll play Mexico in Cincinnati, both in MLS stadiums. There's a feeling that you can kind of control fans there and because you can sell through the local club's season ticket holder base and then in through American Outlaws and other supporters or supporters groups, supporters shield. You can kind of control the fans and get a home crowd. Is there a thought to play these games in Edmonton or in Ottawa or a Calgary, or it's just Vancouver and Toronto?
Logistically, I really can't see it. I can't see it for the European players traveling aspect. So this is what they have. And like, I think the atmosphere was tremendous and I understand what they're saying. I think it's, you want the entire crowd behind you, but I get super jittery when I hear things like blocking off tickets available for only certain amounts of fans. Like when we went against Honduras, initially my friend thought we were sitting in the Honduras section. Like I bought tickets there, but no, it's like we were in the general seating and that's how it worked out. That's just how many fans wanted the ticket. So I think you're right in the sense that like the players are asking other fans who are not there to come out. And it's hard for fans who are there to not feel kind of, not offended, but like, you know what I mean? Like take it as a bit of a slight. So it's a tough conversation and you're right. It gets super weird and uncomfortable, but that's nationalism, baby. And that's soccer.
For sure. So one of the shitty conversations that happens around U.S. soccer is U.S. hosted Costa Rica at Red Bull Arena in the last cycle. And the story, and I was at that game, is there was more Costa Rica fans than U.S. fans, which isn't true. But the U.S. played like crap.
This specific conversation, though, I've seen it pop up several times.
Well, and it's popped up again because of the way U.S. soccer has chosen to distribute the home games over the course of this window or this qualifying cycle as well, right? They're playing in Austin. And I get the idea of playing in MLS stadiums because when they're smaller, you can control them. And if you're selling through the local clubs, then you can kind of have a pulse of what's going on. So I'm not against any of that. But like if the U.S. hadn't played like garbage, it would have sounded like a pro U.S. crowd at Red Bull Arena. Exactly. And the Costa Rica fans, it sounded like a pro Costa Rica crowd because they were happy and excited and cheering for their team. And you said it with the early goal against El Salvador, like it felt like a pro Canada crowd. And that's where it's like, yeah, it's partially on fans and the stadiums and all that stuff, but it's also partially on the players. It's like unfortunately for a home game, you sort of need to win the crowd over. But guess what? Mexico has to do that in the Azteca every time. When Mexico plays poorly, and by poorly we mean like not winning by as many goals as they want, that crowd whistles their team. So there's a give and take to this whole conversation, I think.
So I don't know if Football Reference has this breakdown specifically, but Zavs' XG against at BMO Field, all comps, has got to be something special this year. It has not been pretty, but I think that's a huge result. I had to get that in, you know, I had to get it in. USA, I mean, I watched that game right after I rushed home, not rushed home, but I rushed home off with glee, but with, you know, excitement for I personally have nothing riding on it, but if something goes a certain way, it's like, oh, isn't that nice? It was one of those viewing experiences, but I was very curious to see how the U.S. would look, because I'm talking to you, I'm listening to the discourse, and it's maybe not DEFCON 5, but it's up there. At halftime, it was, though. At halftime, it felt like it was at DEFCON 5, based on the discourse. And then the guy, your guy, Ricardo Pepi. David, how much do you personally take credit for this win in Honduras? I feel like it should be 60-70%.
I mean, after all the long days at the training ground with him, driving him to games, all of that. It's exciting to see. And I think kind of the conversation we just had, we're still in a weird place, I'd say, internally with national teams. Like my fandom in soccer, a lot of it grew through supporting the U.S. men's national team. And it was always this special place. And then over the last 7 years, it's been a little tougher. Both from a soccer point of view and then from a culture and other stuff going on point of view. So to have a kid like Ricardo Pepi be the hero and be who he is, which is an unbelievable human being, a player who Matt Doyle said this to me, which I hadn't thought about, the opportunity he represents to be a Mexican American born superstar for the national team is something we've never had before. And we've had great Latin American players, but not Mexican born, not, you know, coming up through El Paso, coming up. Mm-hmm. And when we talked to him at the All-Star game 2 weeks ago, he was like, all I watched was Liga MX as a kid. I learned MLS once I got into the FC Dallas system. So what he could represent for the national team, I think it is pretty huge, both for the future of players and I think young people seeing themselves represented and wanting to play for this team, to supporting this team because they see themselves represented, to like commercial appeal and all that, which is another conversation. So it was pretty cool to see him do his thing. And it was pretty cool to, I think, be vindicated that I've been watching all of these young players develop and I believe they're better than ever before. And so for him to step through the pathway he has and be ready to compete at that level already shows that it's working and that it's true that like the best young player in the academy setup is going, you know, has the ability to be the best young player in the academy setup globally. And that's one of the things that's new and is really exciting. Obviously, Alfonso Davies led a lot of this. And now you've got Gio Reyna and Pepe and guys like that following it up. But it was awesome to watch. And I'm not going to say he saved the U.S. because I think, and I've said this, and I feel more vindicated on it coming out of this cycle than going into it, that all of these teams have issues and all of them are very close together. And so while we come into it and it's like, oh my God, Canada dropped 2 points to Honduras at home. Well, that's not the formula. By the end of this, it's going to be like, well, then Canada went and won in Costa Rica, which makes no sense, but then came home and lost, you know, to Jamaica. Like, I think that's going to be what this World Cup qualifying is. And so I didn't think the U.S. was going to be dead in the water after this, but to have Pepe be the guy to step up and save it, it was pretty cool. And he's a star. Like everyone I know who isn't really like a hardcore deep cut and not MLS at all, maybe even barely US MNT, they're all like, this Pepe guy's awesome.
It goes to show the industrialization of soccer though, how many and just like how many games have been added and how much it is about responding, like you said, about answering a loss, right? Like I think you could say that there was a big problem at USA at halftime down 1-0. And then you look at what Greg Berhalter does substitution wise compared to his Honduran equivalent, who I don't know if he's been sacked yet, but I think he's being run out of
But the assumption was he would be.
The halftime subs might get him without a passport. But then you have Berhalter making the right calls. And I think he's the right guy for this job as an outsider. I'm pretty confident in that, but I'm guessing that conversation is muted for now, at least until the next crisis, like you mentioned. Looking ahead, though, I mean, some big games coming up, and I look at what we saw out of Canada, and I obviously you would have liked to see them be able to beat Honduras, and then they muster up a really good gutsy performance on the road against the United States, and then take care of business at home against El Salvador. But you could argue that the competition steps up considerably in the next round, and they have two away games and tough trips to Jamaica and Mexico. What would you say is your biggest worry, David, for Canada going forward in terms of competing with those teams, just to close out?
I'd say for Canada going forward, it's interesting. This is, to me, their first road CONCACAF experience. Like, yeah, you went to the US, you got a big result, that's huge, but half the players on your team play in MLS and Alistair Johnston plays in Nashville. Like that's different than going to Mexico and going to Jamaica, even though we're not sure if there'll be fans at either of those games, but especially the Jamaica game. So I think your real concern is, okay, how do these players perform in this moment? They have risen to the level of everything that's been asked of them for a year and a half. They were able to get a huge result in Haiti. They were able to beat Suriname. They were able to rise to the level in Gold Cup. But none of those are this exact challenge. So that's the worry to me. If you come home to Panama with 2 or 3 points, so either you get back-to-back draws or you win one of those two games, that is a huge victory for Canada. And Devang, the one positive thing I see is this is a Canada team that can play against the ball. And so when you look at the game plan of what it takes to win or get a result in Mexico or to win on the road in CONCACAF, it's the formula against the US that Canada used. And it's almost more comfortable at times for this Canadian national team. And so that my one major concern is what I said. And then the other is how Herdman picks to go about this, because it didn't feel like he got it right against Honduras. He got it perfectly right in the next two games of, I'll start David at home because I'm not going to lie. I think Alphonso Davies was going back to Germany before, you know, the El Salvador game.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think it was the idea of I'll start Jonathan David in that game. I'll start Tejan in that game, but I'll start Alphonso Davies on the road against the U.S. And that, okay, how does Richie fit into that? How does Sam Atakube fit into that? How does Larin? And I think those are all the pieces he has to get right over the course of this window. And I can't tell you right now that I'm sure John Herdman will get it right. Same as I can't tell you, I think Greg Berhalter will start with the right team in the right way in his three games because of what we saw this window. But I believe that Herdman had the right ideas to close out the window. And so that's promising.
I just feel like that Mexico game is so huge because obviously, sure, whatever result happens, but to be able to spin off that and then immediately play Jamaica away and needing probably to get points, right? So it's there's no time to rest and it comes fast, but obviously we have a month from now. Yeah.
So the only thing I was going to say is if they get a draw at Mexico, which is an unbelievable result.
Changes
but
everything,
I think
right?
It's possible.
Yeah, right.
But if they do that point and the U.S. point, that's the Honduras draw, right? Those are the 2 points you lost in that Honduras game.
That's right.
And you can throw that out the window and move on. And even if they get a draw at Jamaica, it might be enough. Now you get into a weird spot, which is if Jamaica doesn't improve and you don't beat them and a Panama does and a Mexico goes there and beats them, now you're starting to play that game where it's like, well, you need that result to overcome it. But I don't think you play that yet. I think you look at Canada and say, you can pick up those lost points in these two games.
And who knows how Jamaica's feeling after playing the USA away, right? So lots of variables. Very excited
it's
for
Texas,
the next round.
So you assume it's red listed in England, so there'll be zero players available for Jamaica.
Jesus. Any place where Greg Abbott is a governor should be extremely red listed forever. Can't wait for the next round, but it is a month's time. In the meantime, we will head to MLS, talk about your supporter shield leaders, New England Revolutions, along Revolutions. The Revolution. I think the new Matrix is coming and Revolutions got in my head. I apologize. We'll talk about the Rebs, EPL, Bundesliga coming up next on AFP.
Farrell plays Carlos Heel. Flag will stay down. Even numbers. Heel, look at that move, spins back, lays it off, driven goal, works, and smacked into the back of the net. Tejan Buchanan, welcome back. Tejan Buchanan comes in and delivers. And it starts with, who else? The league leader in assists, Carlos Heel. He turned James Sands inside out.
There you have it. Great call. Give me that call every day of the week than a random Englishman talking over.
Shout out to Charlie Davies. Legend.
Great call. Great call. Tayshaun Buchanan making people laugh all over the world because he is that guy right now. He's not at Bruges yet, though.
Can I drop a crazy stat on you or fact, whatever?
Hit me, please.
It was 366 days ago where he scored his first professional soccer goal.
Just over a year.
Yeah. Wow. That's how far we've come with him. He is a record-setting sale. He's a Canadian national team starter. He is probably a linchpin of probably the Supporter Shield winner, potentially the MLS Cup winner. And it has been pretty much 1 year for him doing it at this level. It's wild.
So it's wild. Shouts to English commentators as well. Not to hate on anyone.
I feel like there's a nice mix.
I know you have your thing. David, as a commentator yourself, we respect you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Don't go back on that. Come on, dude. They have their own side of the ocean. They can work anywhere over there.
You're right. You're going to be calling it Derby all of a sudden. 10-point supporters, Shield lead. 9 games to play. Just reading on the Revs, and we had lead win on last season, David, and they were doing things like this then. And I think we probably should have seen this coming based on how they ended last season. But looking into their history, this isn't a team that's won many trophies at all. I think they have won a U.S. Open Cup, which is shocking to me because they're one of those first teams, right? So I think watching them now, it always kind of felt to me as someone who's worked in the league as well, that they were just a very stable franchise that really was not meh, but nothing to really talk about. There was no reason to really talk about the New England Revolution. And here we are now, where they are so far ahead of everyone else in the East, and now pretty far ahead of everyone else in the West. It's pretty incredible. I guess the question is, what will you remember the most about this Revs team, David, you have in the notes? I think for me, it is personally about being able to focus on the work because of Tajon, and then watching some of the best players in the league kind of emerge expectedly, maybe, as well. If you watched the end of last year, like, Carlos Heel was amazing, but I think we could kind of see this coming. But it's interesting to see it all just kind of end up working out, because sometimes it doesn't go that way.
Yeah. My mind hasn't come around to, they are a record-setting team, which is the pace they're on. And so that was why I put that question in. The vein of, like, I think we've felt pretty confident over the last 2 months. They are one of the two best teams in the league, probably them in Seattle. I think now it's easy to say they're clearly the best team in the league. I don't feel like I'm hit over the head the way I was with LAFC when they set the points record, or obviously TFC doing it in the second year of two back-to-back cup runs. There was already the expectations because they had been to MLS Cup the year before. And I don't feel that way yet with the Revs. And part of that, I think, is discourse. And then part of that is just how undramatic it's been for them. Like, it's just, it's been kind of easy and steady and not these bumps up and down. But I think when we look back, it's going to be one of the best rosters we've ever seen put together. Because you look at the team they played this weekend against NYCFC. Gustavo Bow and Adam Buxa didn't start. And Buxa's coming off, starting alongside Lewandowski for Poland in UEFA qualifying and playing in all three games, scored four goals, but three of them against San Marino. You didn't have Carlos Heel in the starting lineup. You didn't have Tajon Buchanan, who now is probably an eight-figure sale to a Champions League team in Belgium. You didn't have any of those four players on the field against NYCFC, who were missing some pieces, but were a strong group, and they still won the game. And so, like, you look at it, it's one of the best back lines in the league. It's definitely one of the best back fives when you add Matt Turner. And those are the parts we don't talk about.
And another player that I guess I didn't know much as much about, maybe, as some others, Brandon Bye, has, to me, is awesome. Excellent. What a player. And, like, every time, I feel like a lot, I think his name is Kyle Duncan on the Red Bulls. I feel like a similar guy where every time he plays, you're like, okay, but Brandon Bye has exceeded that and more some.
And Bai was a 10 in college that they drafted and converted to right back. And when we were at Combine, the conversation was around doing that with him. DeJuan Jones was a center forward in college that they drafted and moved to left back. And he's a righty. So they've done really impressive things with this group. And that's where you win in MLS, is you maximize everything. You look at the Sounders, right? They bring in Raul Ruiz Diaz and Nico Lodero, superstars. They're also playing Josh Atencio and Ethan Dablier, academy players. They're also bringing Shane O'Neill in and Kellen Rowe and getting the most out of them and drafting Alex Roldan and Christian Roldan. You have to hit everywhere to be a great team in MLS. You can make the playoffs if you do one thing well, but you have to be able to hit all over to be a really great team. New England has done that. I think when we look back in 10 years, this is going to be one of the best rosters we've ever seen in MLS history.
Because we have to, and we love Canada. We will take a tour of what happened in MLS in Canada terms right now, but it was a depressing weekend, I think you could say. The Whitecaps win streak is over, a loss to the surging Portland Timbers. We left the Portland Timbers for dead, but it turns out Sebastian Blanco is sick, and he can lead a team to some good stuff. So a bit of a blip for the Whitecaps. Montreal loses to an excellent Nashville team at home. No shame in that, but that race is getting muddy. And I know you like what Inter Miami's doing. Shouts to Phil Neville, but it looks like he's found something there. I doubt either team makes the playoffs at this point. Do you disagree?
Ooh, wow. I did not think you were going to come at that angle.
To see how low my voice went, though, I tried to forget a real somber tone, because I know it's depressing, but it's true.
Okay, which of the two do you think has a better chance?
Just based on how the East is working out, probably CF Montreal. I think without Mason Toy, you see there is like an absolute struggle to score, and Mihailovic is an excellent story, but I think there's a piece missing there going forward, but I feel like you can grind out some dirtiness in the East, whereas in the West, it might be a bit harder with the way LAFC is looking now and just the talent on the other teams around the Whitecaps. So I like my FC Montreal's chances, but even then, I think Atlanta
to hold off Atlanta. Miami has a game in hand. If they were to win that, they would jump all the way to fifth in the East right now, which would push Philly and DC down. So you have to beat out DC. It's a grind in either conference. I don't think it's an easy one. And I think a lot of it's going to be on like form and energy, right? Like if you get a couple results, but it feels to me like Vancouver, even with this loss, is trending in one direction and Montreal is trying. They've been treading since a great start to sort of stay in that conversation. They've had big results in there, but it as you said, grind it out. It doesn't feel like they're a team that can really grab the games against some of these opponents and be able to like cruise at any point. And so with the addition of Ryan Gauld, Vancouver has the look of a playoff team. I think it's all going to come down to Lucas Cavallini. You need something out of him. Brian White has been really good since they picked him up. That's probably not going to be enough to carry you to the playoffs. So I look at that and say, if they can get 5 goals out of Cavallini down this stretch, if he can be a player that attracts center backs and creates space for Dahomey and Gauld and Caicedo in those moments, all of that stuff, then I think Vancouver is good enough to make the postseason.
We had the Vanny Frazier poll. I know TFC fans loving that. 1-1 draw.
They love it, by the way. Does anyone in MLS love each other as much as Greg Vanny and Robin Frazier?
It's like a family reunion as well, because the assistant coaching staffs is full of their boys.
I'm surprised Kalishman didn't just take Robin Fraser's Achilles in the middle of the game just for fun.
1-1 though. Those teams are probably, I don't know if the Galaxy would call themselves comfortable, but it's interesting. Seattle looks like Seattle again. They got some key guys. I think Stephen Fry came back this weekend. MLS heating up, almost done the regular season. Revs leading the supporters shield. We won't really talk about the TFC game. The less said, the better. But before we move to Europe quickly, David, I'm curious on that note about worst teams you've ever seen. We've had some instances in TFC past where there's been some bad outfits. I don't think this team is as bad as some of those. But what, in your mind, is the worst MLS team you can remember?
That's a brutal question.
It is.
It feels like some of the down DC teams in the Ben Olsen years, because they were like boring
anti-football
and lifeless. Yeah,
against football. Yeah,
like a lot of like retread MLS dudes who we all knew were past it or injured, and Chris Korb and whatever else was going on. So those feel like some bad ones. The Dynamo have had some bad ones over the last few years as well. Obviously, Anthony Hudson's Colorado Rapids were pretty brutal.
I'll tell you this, and they're an expansion team, so it's not fair, but having watched a bit of Austin this weekend, they're pretty damn bad. They are pretty damn bad.
And I celebrated them as like a proper expansion build. And man, did they go out of their way to make me look like an asshole.
All right, we go from the negative to the positive. It was a fantastic weekend in Germany. If you love juicy storylines, juicy bratwurst, I guess, if you want to stay on brand. But there was some... Unreal. Excellent things in terms of Julian Nagelsmann returning with his Bayern boys to RB Leipzig, along with Upamecano and Sabitzer. Sabitzer, my man, you had to go dark side. Kills me. But
so did you watch this game live at all?
I didn't watch it live. No.
Okay. So I don't know if this was an ESPN thing or a World Feed thing, but at halftime of the game, they showed a highlight reel of Sabitzer's best goals in his Bundesliga career. And I don't know if that was like, oh, Sabitzer's the story, or it's like a World Feed thing where it's running on every game, because I wasn't watching the halftime of the other games. But that is such a cold-blooded thing to do.
I do think it is a World Feed thing, because there's like these random clip videos that they have, and I wonder if it's like an algorithm that gets them into the queue if it's just like name. So it's like Sabitzer, best goals. It turns out they're all for RB Leipzig, but... and then not just that game, but then you had Dortmund and Leverkusen playing a hell of a game, and Florian Wirtz being the new German wonder kid, 18 years old, who looks like an absolute baller. But that game is decided by a sketchy penalty. But I guess we're left with two excellent games in terms of storylines. I wonder where you wanted to start.
Well, the Dortmund Leverkusen game, it's partially why neither of them will challenge Bayern, but it's also why I watch this league every week, is that's a huge game. And these coaches just opened it up and were like, let's play. Like, there was no thought process of how to close the game down or at any point either team trying to protect the lead. It was wide open. It was aggressive. There was gaps between defenders. There was space for all of these young attacking players to play. Like, I think that is the opening thought to me, Devang, is this is why the Bundesliga, I think, might be the most entertaining league in the world right now.
And like, I mean, Twitter at this point is mostly poison. Like, I think it's 98% poison. But one of the positives, the few positives, is that the hive mind of being like, if you weren't watching this game, you should be watching it now. They're usually right. And
yeah,
I wasn't watching this game to start, but when you initially tune in and then see Patrick Schick scoring goals, our Euro star friend, and Rafael Guerrero scoring a nice free kick. Then you had a Jude Bellingham showing his just hand-eye coordination, catching a beer can, throwing it at Haaland. And then the penalty at the end, which I think probably was a penalty, but I think it's two-letter of the law. It's not playing to the game, if that is too bullshit hockey. But I feel like that's a hockey reference, but they didn't need to make that call, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. But I think in the end, the way Leverkusen reacted to their lead in a way allowed Dortmund to get back into this game. Like, Leverkusen went ahead,
right.
And they made a couple subs, and it felt like, okay, now they're going to try and close this thing down. And then they didn't at all. And they didn't try and, like, not go to the corner in the 60th minute, but, like, slow the momentum, try and get numbers in between Brandt and Royce so that they weren't able to link up at all. There was no point of that. And so I think that's where, while maybe the penalty is iffy, Dortmund probably deserved to win this game, did enough to win this game. And that's a little frustrating, I think. I look at this Leverkusen team, you bring up Wirtz, and it's like, they are a machine in producing high quality players, and they sell them on, and then the next one comes through. And so they're an impressive club. I don't know that we talk about them enough in terms of being one of those teams, but Julian Brandt was one of those guys, right?
Kai Havertz,
they built their whole team around him. And then Kai Havertz steps in when Brandt gets sold to Dortmund. And now Havertz is gone. And now Wirtz steps in. So this club and some of its international as well, with Paulinho and Frimpong in this game, who I thought Frimpong was phenomenal from right wing back. So, yeah, it was impressive to watch. When you talk about these teams, you're always talking about, oh, this is the next generation of talent. At some point, you got to start to win stuff with the generation you have on the field, which hasn't been easy for these groups. But this was the best game of the weekend, hands down, in any league.
Do you have anything to add about Bayern? I mean, for Nagelsmann, I mean, it must feel nice, but you got to win with that squad.
Yeah, and I think Leipzig, as much as they do well, they are not consistently goal dangerous. Like, I look at Nkunku, who I think at times the best player on the field, when he's not, it's not just that he's not brilliant. He's sloppy. He kills the attack for them. Andre Silva kind of disappeared in this game. And that's been the issue for Leipzig. Even though you give up four goals and you've lost Upamecano, you watch this game, and if they take the chances they create, they have the flow of the game. They have the crowd behind them. They're pressuring Bayern, and they just have not been goal dangerous like that. It feels like Szoboszlai, his, you know, elevation to the level we think he's going to get to happening quickly is probably the biggest answer for this team. But unfortunately, it feels like an early point to say, like, it's Bayern's league again, and let's see if anyone can catch them. And it doesn't feel like that's possible. I think Wolfsburg are in first right now. Obviously, they had a huge season last year. They're in Champions League this year. They have not played head to head, but I don't know that Wolfsburg has a deep enough squad to contend with this Bayern group.
From what I watched, Danny Almo is very good. I feel like he is one of those guys that's going to go for a load of money very soon.
You think he'll go for a load of money to Bayern Munich?
Florian Wirtz too. As we'll get to later, as I see in the mailbag, there's a question that alludes to this, not to foreshadow too much. Okay, to England, Arsenal has won a game, David, and they scored a goal 1-0 against Norwich. I was about to do the instrumental through my, what an agonizing watch. What an absolute agonizing watch. But they won, felt great, to be honest, just to get out from under the gun and out of the relegation zone. But big picture, EPL-wise, the heavyweights, it looks like this race is going to be absolutely incredible. And the field talent that is now here is a bit staggering. We saw all of the big teams win. Chelsea winning against Aston Villa, took their chances. Villa played well, I thought. Tyrone Mings.
Yeah, they outplayed Chelsea mistake, completely.
That Mings mistake killed me. I was like, why? Yeah. Why? City, not pretty-ish, but 1-0 over Leicester. And then, of course, the big one, Manchester United 4-1 over Newcastle at home. Pogba looking like the best player in the world, possibly. And Cristiano Ronaldo scoring twice, Bruno scoring a worldie as well. Who impresses you the most so far? I think everyone's like, United, are they title contenders? Are they back? Are they back? I look at the squad on paper. There's some issues for sure. And I think teams that are harder to break down will probably be able to catch them with their DMs and whoever they have out there and whoever's playing center back. But overall, sure, hell yeah, they are contenders. I can't really say they're not.
Yeah, it's too much talent. I until I'm proven wrong, I will assume Ole is not a good enough manager to win this league against a Jurgen Klopp and a Pep Guardiola because they have similar talent and similar squads. And you could put Tuchel in there as well if you want to. So right now, I think that's their deficiency. And 3-4 games in, I'm not going to be proven wrong. So to me, it's been Chelsea. I think the Liverpool draw was a draw that was a win because of the nature of the game after the red card, the way they just completely shut up shop and did not give a single opportunity to Liverpool. And then you come here against Aston Villa, and as I said, I thought Villa was the better team. They were more dangerous. They were more creative. Chelsea wins 3-0. If you're going to win a league, games where you're playing a top six or seven team and you are poor and you win 3-0, that's how you win the league. And so I know
you
there's...
You think Aston Villa is a top six or seven team?
I mean, name the other group. Like, name the other sides that are going to be up there.
Wow.
So you got Man U, Chelsea, yeah. Liverpool, Man City. That's four. Tottenham, you assume is in there.
Everton's probably, you know, it's close though. I think Everton and them are close. So yeah, all right, continue. I'll allow it.
Yeah, and it's not like a huge compliment to Aston Villa, but I think they would have been close last year. And right. And I don't think they've gotten worse, even though they lost Grealish with the way they've played in the attack over the course of this year and how strong they are in central midfield. So yeah, I thought that this was an impressive result. Lukaku clearly was the best striker in the world, or second best behind Lewandowski in Italy. He's the same player he was. Saul was a low-key awesome pickup for them, even though he struggled a little in this game. And then you've got a bunch of different pieces that it seems like fit pretty well under Tuchel. So I've been impressed by Chelsea. It's mainly been living up to what I thought it would look like. And so I think it's been a good start.
Because watch out, Arsenal's coming, baby. Burnley away. Burnley away, Wimbledon, I think, in some sort of cup. These random cup games are so important now because there's just no games. There's no Europe. Just so hungry for runouts. It's a sad
League's
time.
Cup's okay. All you've ever dreamt of.
All right. That is it for our European roundup. Again, staying positive. When we come back, we close up shop with the mailbag. It's Ask AFP coming up next.
Welcome back, and now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, hashtag AskAFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Interesting that this is Nick's copy, which I'm proud to read for him. I didn't do the voice this time. He writes the word hashtag, but then puts a hashtag in front of AskAFP.
Shocking.
That's a dangerous thing.
It's one of the more shocking things I've seen, but I wanted to leave it there so people can remember this. And I'm glad you caught it, David, because I was
do not delete it.
Shocked and appalled when I saw it. It's true, though. It's also like, honestly, though, I made a lot of audio mistakes saying hashtag. So he might have done that for me. So you know what? What a guy. What a guy.
I always remember back to one of my first jobs broadcasting. I was in college at my school in Boston. And one of the dudes who was calling, I think, hockey at the time, this was like early on, and he wrote, he did a read, and it was like #GoNU, follow #GoNU. And I was like, man,
you
dude.
Idiot.
But now I'm like coming back around where it's like, if someone gave me a TikTok read and said a bunch of terms I didn't know, I'd sound like an idiot
When was the first time you remember using the hashtag? I'm trying to, was this a Twitter thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Good Lord.
I think it was. I think everyone called it a pound sign before that. Although I have, now I'm completely off the rails, but you give me one segment to host and you're out of control.
I was going to ask you when you got Twitter next. When did you get Twitter exactly as well?
So I actually was forced into getting Twitter. I had a journalism professor who would put one question on Twitter for each test in college. And it was like, you get a free answer. And I didn't have a Twitter handle. And I was the last person in the class to do it. And he literally sat me down and he was like, dude, I'm giving you questions. Just make a handle. And I was like, I'm never going to do it. And then I got on. And the first time I loved Twitter was the transfer window, I think, when Fabregas left and Arsenal signed like five dudes, right?
Guys. Yabos. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like Arteta and Mertesacker. It was all happening at the same time. And it was like, whoa, how do I follow all of this? And then I had this phone and it had this app and it just did it all for me. So that was pretty good.
Was your professor trying to boost his follower count? That's what I'm inferring here. Was he trying to get you to follow him, basically?
Interesting. I mean, he was an Emmy-winning journalist and he was
for clout, though.
He had a commercial where he was wearing a leather jacket and would be like breaking the news, hard-hitting journalism. Wow. So he didn't need us. Wow. He doesn't care. On the back of that, let's get into our first question. Mark asks, in a wide-ranging interview with Kicker, RB Leipzig head coach Jesse Marsch had this to say. Quote, as an American, I can't understand how Bielefeld is supposed to have a chance against Bayern. For example, citing 30 times larger budget. Today, The Athletic reports Bayern may have been actually planning to join the ESL. Why doesn't Bayern get more stick for being a baddie?
Excellent question, Mark. I think, honestly, it's some genius PR. It is going to North America and getting some youngsters who are sick and having them play over there. So we can't say a bad word about them from an international viewpoint. But I think internally, I think it is kind of sus. And I was reading also about the other big clubs in Germany going through some really tough times. So I think there is maybe some correlation there. I'm curious if you have more insight on this, David, but you have some heavyweights really down in the dumps, like your Schalkes, who are relegated and it doesn't seem like they're coming back anytime soon. And yet you have Bayern, who seems to be consolidating talent. And basically every youngster that comes up that's somewhat available, they will get them. So Florian Wirtz will play for them eventually along with whoever else. So like, is this cool? Like, I think the ESL, this is David Ornstein reporting in The Athletic that at these club meetings at the EFA to appoint the new leaders, it ended up being PSG, which no one wanted, but no one wanted Bayern either because they were apparently involved deeply in the ESL talks as well. So I just, out of all of that mess of the last summer and all of the chicanery, Bayern came out pretty well. And I think they still come out pretty well, but it's weird how we don't consider them just as quote unquote evil as some of these other big ass clubs.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think part of it is they run themselves a little better than these other teams. They are not uber wasteful. So again, while they do get to just cherry pick from across Germany, they play those players. Most of them perform fairly well for them. And they don't go get Jack Grealish, you know, 2 days or a year after they went and got Mahrez. Like, I think they've operated more within their means as well as being partially fan owned. So they are not, while they have corporate buy-in, they are not an oil state that is running their team. So I think all of that kind of has moved them to the side a little bit of where fans see them. I think at the timing of how all this has gone down, to have Pep Guardiola when they did also probably put them in like the people who see the beautiful game that way eyes. So I think all of that has shifted the way they're seen. And while it's, that's the reality, right? That's these people. And I don't knock any of them. And then I think there's also the part of like Schalke's bad because Schalke set, like Schalke ran themselves incorrectly.
They did it to themselves.
Yeah. There's a lack of money in Germany and it puts teams in a situation where Bayern does get Marcel Sabitzer for €8.5 million, which is nuts. And so that sucks, but it's not like in England where teams are collapsing and going into bankruptcy because of the big teams pushing them in that direction. So it's a little bit different, but I don't think it's wrong to say that they should be seen closer to those big clubs than they should to, you know, some of the teams that we think of that are doing things right or are there for the fans.
It's a way more charitable way of putting it, and I think you're right. But I think that is the reasonable viewpoint, and interestingly enough, I have a lot of Bayern supporting friends who kind of cite the idea that they're not as bad in that sense. Not just they don't support them because of that reason only, but in explaining their justification, it's like, well, look at these other clowns, and I look at who owns Arsenal. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to disagree with them, right? And I do really do think though that the way that they've acquired players and who they've acquired is a bit strategic in this sense as well. That it's like this global goodwill PR ambassadorship. Like they're getting amazing youngsters from all over the place who are impossible to root against, and it's working, sucking us all in.
Absolutely. Last question here. Sergio asks, we talk about attacking players a lot. If you had two center backs, you had to go into a match for the fate of the earth on its shoulders. Who are the two center backs all time that you're choosing to put out there?
All time. Oh, God.
Yeah. Who are your guys?
This is a horrible question to put me on the spot of, but I will say all time, I'll do like one heart, one head. Yeah. Heart, I'll pick Sol Campbell as one.
I knew you were going to say Sol Campbell. I was going to make a joke about it, and I didn't.
Love Sol Campbell. I'd pick Tony Adams as well, but I'll probably try and pick someone a bit more modern for the current center back. I'm trying to think of a center back I love watching on the ball these days.
Doesn't have to be current, or it could be like a Mats Hummels who was slightly current, but
right.
is not as
right,
current.
Right.
Do you want me to start chiming in while you're
Please,
thinking?
Please, yeah. You chime in and I'll give you my last guy.
So the one guy all time that I swear by is Ricardo Carvalho. I think he was the best center back in the world at his peak.
Wow, okay.
And I think John Terry, a lot of the buzz around Terry is like thankful to Carvalho being his partner and being elite and world class. So Carvalho gets in there for me as one of them. The other one is tough. There's a lot of good players who at their peaks are guys that, again, I would swear by and be happy to put in there. I think Thiago Silva, for his stretch of like 3-4 years when he was at that level, he's a guy who you trust on the ball, but was also a dominating physical defender and could organize a back line in like the more recent times. I'd put Hummels in there as well. And he's had his spells where he's been that guy. Diego Godin is one for me.
I think I got it. Okay. Give me Sol Campbell and Marcel Desailly as my center back pairing. Oh. Not just because Marcel Desailly has my last name nearly identical with some I-L-L-Y added to the end, but also a legend and when I really started watching football, part of a monster France team that I was in love with. So I think I will go Desailly Campbell as my pairing.
Interesting. Okay.
Great question.
Should I follow your lead and also go with the legendary French center back?
Do it.
And Lilian Thuram. Okay. I'm going to say those two for me all time, but Godin is close and Thiago Silva is close as well. And on that note, that's Ask AFP.
We're done.
Do you want me to do this read for you, Devang, or you want to close it out?
I do. I always enjoy seeing you read scripted stuff because you add your own flair to it. So let's hear it.
All right. That's it, folks. Before we go, if you can please rate and review the podcast, that would be incredible. Plus, hit us up on Twitter at A Football Pod, as well as on Patreon, www.patreon.com/afootballpodcast. And lastly, thank you for listening to A Football Podcast. For myself, David Goss, and my partner, Devang Desai, and the spirit of Nick Andrade, and then D. Wilson, of course, on the beats, on the ones and
the
twos.
The ones and twos,
say, right?
Right.
Yeah. What does that mean, the ones and twos?
I don't know. I wish I was. I'm exposing myself how uncool I am, but I don't know exactly what it means. I'm assuming it's about the device itself, but please do not tweet at me if you know the answer.
Okay. Sounds good. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Should we play Celebrate? da, 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 da.